Good evening and welcome back to the Journey Home program. I'm your host, John Mark Grodi, here at EWTN. And once again, we have this great privilege to come together to hear a story of faith and conversion. We're joined tonight by Dr. Justice Hunter. He's a former Free Methodist, and he entered the church in 2021 with his family. And he's the Associate Professor of Church History at the United Theological Seminary in Dayton, Ohio. Justice, thanks for being here.
Glad to be here.
Yeah, great to have you sharing your story and your over there teaching church history.
Yeah.
Not far from here in Ohio.
Yeah. I know. That's Ohio. Has some a few church historians around. Yeah, that's
right. Well, it's an important topic, obviously. You know, it shows up in so many stories, church history, you know, because Christianity is a historical religion, mm-hmm. right? It has a history. It rests on historical events. And, you know, what's happened since then between us and Christ matters a lot.
Right. So yeah, that's exactly right. Yeah, that was a huge issue I was wrangling with in my own, all my life, really.
Right.
Yeah.
Awesome. Well, let's go back to the beginning. Where does your life and your story begin?
Yeah, so I was born. My parents were United Methodists. My father graduated from college and wanted to go into ministry, and so he took a job as a youth pastor at a Jacksonville United Methodist Church in Jacksonville, Alabama, which was my mom's home church. And she was, you know, the young single lady who volunteered with the youth to kind of help out. And so so they met there. I'm told their first meeting, one of the youth introduced my mother to my father and said, "This is Melinda Hamilton, and she's looking for a husband." So they met there. They worked together for, you know, with the youth for 2 months. They started dating for 2 months, and then they were engaged for 2 months, married, and, you know, 40 years of, you know, marriage. So I was raised in a Methodist family. Shortly thereafter, they moved. I was born, and Dad decided to go to seminary. He wanted to be a senior pastor, not a youth pastor. Yeah. And so we moved to Asbury Seminary in just south of Lexington, Kentucky.
Okay.
And there, my parents started attending a Free Methodist church. They had been United Methodist and now started attending a Free Methodist church. And the Free Methodist church is part of kind of the holiness movement. It broke away from the Methodist Episcopal Church, kind of main Line Methodist Church in the, I think, 1860, something like that, over a number of issues. And it tends to be, at least in the South where I was raised, it's pretty small. There's a few little churches here and there. Mm-hmm. And people tend to be less affluent than United Methodist, a little less socially kind of established. So that's what I was raised in. Dad pastored churches. A brother was born while he was at seminary. And then he pastored churches in Gallatin, Tennessee, just north of Nashville, Johnson City, Tennessee, far northeast corner of the state, Huntsville, Alabama. We bounced through all those areas. And his ministry really was itinerant in the sense that Methodists talk about itinerancy. We moved every 3 years. Mm-hmm. The Free Methodist system is a little different. There are bishops, but they don't do a lot of the functional work. The functional work is done by the district superintendent, okay, who sends you places like a bishop would. And so the district superintendent would call pretty much every 3 years and say, "Hey, we've got this church, you know, in Huntsville, and it's really great. I think it's a great opportunity for you. You know, plan to move in August." And, you know, and we'd get in the car and move, and you would expect this to be this great opportunity. And then I remember that one was very notable because we got there and we go to the church, and my family doubled the congregation that Sunday, you know. So it was a little, there was a lot of moving as a result. And also it forced certain economic challenges on the family. So my father was always working two or three jobs. His passion was ministry, but then, you know, to make ends meet, he would mow the lawn at the cemetery or cut trees. He cut trees for the power company. Wow. He's from, you know, blue collar sharecropping, mm-hmm, people in northern Alabama, so just sweat work was what he could do on the side. So yeah, he could really pursue his passion, which was ministry, preaching, reading scripture, caring for people. Yeah. So that was my childhood. I moved many times, and I noticed as growing up, I would be really, the church was the continuous thing for me, the Free Methodist Church. Our whole family life kind of centered around that. Being a pastor's kid is a very shaping experience. But also, combined with that, I always had this sense of desire for deep belonging from all the moving. I'd move from place to place to place. And it was pretty much consistent. Every 3 years, I had to start over, build a new set of friends, go into a new school, find new rhythms and things. And that was a real challenge for me, the way I think I'm wired. That was challenging for me growing up. I really wanted to feel a sense of acceptance, belonging, and sort of settledness in place. So over time, as I was growing older, I remember a couple of significant moves. One was when we moved to Huntsville, I believe it was my seventh grade year, we moved from Johnson City, Tennessee to Huntsville, Alabama, and Dad took the church there, and I didn't know anyone. And I had started kind of playing guitar a little bit at the time, and had been begging my dad to buy me a guitar, and he said, "Oh, you just play at your friend's house, you know, we don't have money for that." Well, we made this move, and Mom and Dad thought, or probably my mom convinced my dad, "Let's get him a guitar. He needs something to do, you know. We moved in the summer. He has no friends." So he bought me a guitar and started taking guitar lessons, and that became kind of like a key outlet for me.
Yeah.
As we made this transition, so I started growing, you know, going through adolescence now. More complicated interior life is developing for me, and I would use that guitar, the music thing, to kind of create space. And also, I discovered that it's a helpful way to kind of get in middle school, high school. You need kind of like your thing for your identity, you know.
Yeah.
And that really kind of became it to music. You know, what do you do? Well, I play guitar when I'm in free time. And people kind of thought that was cool. You know, I was not very athletic, so that wasn't an option. So I would play guitar. I'd go to school, and I started developing friendships with other people who were into music and into you know, rock or something like that. And so, you know, we'd have these terrible garage bands, and that became sort of my little sense of belonging. These other guys I'd play and you know, terrible music in their garage. But that community really, I think, was kind of the first place where I felt a real sense of deep kind of camaraderie with people outside the church. And increasingly, that kind of created a world where I sort of started to get between these two places, you know. These friends were not, maybe their parents made them go to church, but no one was intensely serious about their faith as my family was as a pastor's kid. And so going into high school, I found myself sort of shifting between these two spaces, you know. Yeah. Go to school, do this, and then this. And increasingly, that was my identity, and then I would just appease mom and dad, you know, on this other side. Until I think it was the summer after my freshman year of high school. Free Methodists have this, and a lot of Wesleyans in the Holiness tradition have this old camp meeting tradition, which mm-hmm. is, you know, summer times, you spend time and you get it, pull out, and you go to camp, and you, you know, hear preaching, a lot of altar call, and not altar call for conversion, but altar call for deepening union with Christ is how I describe it now, kind of as if placing yourself on the altar in this kind of kind of tradition. And I spent a lot of time in prayer that summer because I've been wrangling with this, and really felt that God was calling me to be more intent in forming my identity around the church and so on. And so I came back and kind of wrestled with that for a year or so, and just more engaged at church. And then my dad got called to take another job. Actually, he went to be a funeral director in Johnson City. That's okay. In Johnson City, Tennessee. He had been mowing the lawn at the funeral home while pastoring there.
Right.
And now the funeral home had an opening. So we went back there. Dad was a funeral director and then working in kind of, I think the decision was mostly an economic one. He decided that since I was really frustrated with this move, I did not want to make it. I didn't feel that I had voice in it. I now recognize it was the right decision, but I was very frustrated with it. And so as that thing shook out, my parents made the decision that justice gets to decide where we go to church. Okay, we're going to move here. Dad is no longer in a parish-type ministry, church ministry. His ministry now was working in the funeral home. He was a funeral director and then also kind of the pastor at that community and doing some hospice chaplaincy sort of type things as well. And so we'll let justice pick the church. We didn't want to go back to the Free Methodist Church because dad had been the pastor there, and that's sort of complicated.
Yeah.
So we start doing the tour of churches, and we go to this big church. I didn't know anything about doctrine or anything like that. What I knew was this church had lots of youth, and they gave out free donuts every Sunday. And so I was like, okay, that's the church that we should go to. So we started going to that church. And
it's not a Methodist church?
It was not, actually. It was a non-denominational church. Okay. I think that the shaping influence was Dallas Theological Seminary. Okay. And that was really difficult for my father. Theologically, it was very different.
Okay.
He didn't really get involved there. There was really no way for him to do ministry in that space. So... But I liked it for the community. I saw a community of people, and I wanted to belong and be a part of a community. And I think that I did want it to be church centered as we were kind of making this transition.
Right.
And that's what I saw there, and when I went after. And that really did. That was a good move for me because I formed relationships with other young people my age who were of various degrees serious about their faith, and they had a robust youth program with leaders, young adults, you know, college students, who could kind of offer mentorship and guidance. And they did that really quite well. So I went through that period kind of pretty serious about my faith. I think that was really a formative time of me carving out a big space for faith in my life. And it was also where I met my wife, my future wife. So she would come to our youth group some, although she was a part of a different church. And we, both of our fathers were not pastoring churches, but in ministry adjacent professions. Her father's a marriage and family therapist.
Gotcha.
And from the independent Christian churches. And he and my father were somehow convinced by a friend of mine to offer to teach a morning Bible study in my living room before school every Wednesday, I think it was. So my father-in-law, my future father-in-law, my father, every Wednesday morning, and my future wife and all of our friends would gather in the living room of a house, which was convenient because it was just down the hill from the school, and do Bible study before going to school. And so that was kind of good. It was really very good. Mm-hmm. I then went to Asbury College in Wilmore, Kentucky, where my father had gone, and I just was kind of not sure what I wanted to do, but I wanted to continue a serious pursuit of the faith, and I wanted to go somewhere where I would have that sense of belonging around the faith, and that was exactly what happened at Asbury. My first year, I came into a floor of full of freshmen. And most of them were pretty serious about their faith. They weren't just there for college. They went to Asbury for faith reasons. And we formed just a deep community of fellowship and worship and prayer. But unfortunately, it some theological issues kind of arose in that community that led to some division and fragmenting and a little bit of kind of factional division, I would say. During that freshman year, which kind of ended it on a bad note, but still kind of pressed along. I was involved in a ministry called Young Life, which is sort of a evangelistic ministry to high school, the local high school. And my wife also was involved. We were not dating at the time, but we just kind of, she went to Asbury College also. Mm-hmm. We were not dating at the time, but we both got involved in the same ministry. We started doing ministry together. We were both really sold out Christians, as it were. You know, that was what we were doing. We were all in on our faith. You know, I thought at the time I was going to probably finish college and then go into ministry with Young Life. Actually, was kind of what I expected to happen with my life, and started kind of preparing that way, working that way, working in the schools. Started working in the alternative school with kind of difficult children through Young Life's ministry, and I thought this might be what I do. Well, my senior year, we started dating the summer before my senior year. I kind of burnt out, honestly. Mm-hmm. I came in with mononucleosis. The ministry got really hard. And I was starting to think that I'm not so sure this is what I want to do in this chapter of life. And just kind of started running out of steam that way. And I found, though, alongside that, an awakening of interest in theology. I'd been a pretty mediocre student up until probably my sophomore year of college. I was just disinterested. Until I took a class on, I think it was on modern theology, and I started reading modern theology. I read, I think, Bultmann, and I had like a crisis, and Paul Tillich, who are these kind of liberal Protestant thinkers. And I was, you know, in crisis that the couple of weeks, you know, and then I read Karl Barth, and I was like, okay, maybe this will stabilize. And I just started reading kind of voraciously for class on the side, theology. And then graduating, get married, and I need to do something professionally. I had a degree in Bible and theology, which is basically not marketable unless you go into ministry. And I pretty much burned out on kind of doing ministry for a season. Mm-hmm. And so I just took whatever job I could. I started selling Mazdas. That's where I found a job. I applied everywhere, you know.
Yeah.
I started selling Mazdas, and I would go to work, and I would sell cars and be filled with self-loathing and these sorts of things. Just lack of fulfillment, you know, this is not scratching any itch. And then I'd come home and I'd decompress by sitting on the couch and reading, you know, Karl Barth's Church Dogmatics. So I did this for a few months until my wife finally said to me, look, you're miserable, you know, you hate your job, but you love this. What I want you to do, let's just figure out how to make this be what you do when you go away from me during the day. So when you come home, you know, it's different. So that's why I went to seminary. I went to Asbury Theological Seminary, and I sat down in the provost's office and said, I want to learn theology. I want to learn about Karl Barth. I don't know if I can do that here. And he was very, very kind and said, well, you know, we'll figure it out. Just come on. And so I did that. I went to Asbury Seminary. And that started a whole new kind of cycle of deliberation, discernment. I knew that I was a pastor's kid, and I did not have a strong desire for pastoral ministry. I had lived that life in a certain sense.
Right.
And I knew that what I needed to do was, if I was going to do that, I needed a very clear and pronounced sense of vocation for it. Mm-hmm. I needed, Jesus needed to show up and say, do this, you know, in a very clear way to me. And that had not happened. That had not really not happened. And so I wasn't sure what I was doing in seminary. I tried a bit of this, a bit of that. I actually was in the Air Force Chaplain Candidate Program. So I spent some time in the Air Force Reserves pursuing and thinking about becoming an Air Force chaplain because I liked working with young people. While I was doing that, I started performing well academically, I discovered, you know, I just kept reading. Professors like that if you read and read and read beyond what you're asked to read. And that really kind of started to seem like a potentially possible option for me professionally. And so I had several conversations with faculty. Some had mentioned things to me about whether I'd like to keep studying. And so I started asking people, the faculty I trusted and admired, whether or not this was something to do, and talking with my wife and praying about it. And it seemed, yeah, I think this is the next step for us, or at least we'll try and see. So,
well, at this point, before we go on, where were you guys going to church, and what would you have thought yourself at this point? Were you would identify as a Methodist?
I was a Free Methodist.
Free Methodist.
Yeah, I was a Free Methodist. That's right. Yeah, I was a Free Methodist.
Gotcha.
Yeah, I went to school Free Methodist.
Yeah.
She was Independent Christian Churches. She was going to Independent Christian Church. We got married and we bounced between the two, and then we settled kind of in Free Methodism.
Theologically, that's kind of where you were at.
Yeah,
so at this point.
That's right.
Okay.
And so we were a Free Methodist church. The Free Methodist Church was sponsored me in the chaplaincy. I was a Free Methodist Church chaplain candidate. That was sort of an ordination process had begun there that I was discerning.
Right.
And specifically for the chaplaincy, and then on the other side, you know, what I really wanted to do was just go to the library and haunt the stacks and read, you know.
Yeah.
And so I got to the end of seminary and I thought, well, I don't want to do the chaplaincy. That's not suited to what I want to do. because I had some serious conversations about, well, if I become an Air Force chaplain, can I pursue graduate work as well? That's something I really think I want to do. And it was clear that was going to be too complicated to work out. So once it became an either or, it became clear, let's continue this academic path. So I began reading, though, and this whole process, I start reading modern theology, right? I wanted to study Karl Barth. I wanted to study Protestant, modern Protestant theology. Through that and through reading more broadly and what's going on in the academy, this would have been, Ratzinger's Pope. There's a lot of interest that has spillover effect in the Protestant academy, of interest in early church and historic Christianity. Mm-hmm. And so I start kind of finding myself following these trails, mostly through Catholic influence and Protestant theology, into reading early and medieval Christianity. And so I start reading the Fathers. And I'm really captivated by that literature. I have a couple of professors who aren't experts in the literature but offer guidance, hand me books, say read this person and that person, because they kind of dabble on the side as well. So I get to the end, I think, well, this is really what I want to do, but I don't really know. I can't study that here. I don't know what Protestant school I can go to. I'm from Alabama, Methodist my whole life. I don't even know if I had a Catholic friend up to this point in my life. But I knew Catholics knew about early Christianity. Mm-hmm. So I just applied to a bunch of master's programs at Catholic schools and ended up at the University of Dayton.
Yeah.
And there I was able to study the tradition. And that really pulled me on this whole new trajectory that's shaped my life from that point forward.
What were some things you were finding in the Early Church Fathers that were intriguing to you?
Yeah, I was really interested in the way in which the way they read Scripture fascinated me, mm-hmm. And the way in which they read Scripture in a manner that has a very active sense that the Triune God is doing transformative work in our souls to conform us to the pattern of Christ. That actually really resonated with my holiness background,
right.
Because Wesleyans, especially Holiness Wesleyans, really are about trying to pursue Christ-likeness in their life.
Yeah.
And I thought, wow, there are all these people I never knew about who are reading the Scriptures as patterns of transformation, the life of holiness, growth in virtue, and conformity to Christ. And so, Augustine has always been kind of the major figure for me, but also I was reading the Cappadocians, and Athanasius, and that kind of the set of the text that you typically read at this point. And that's what that really compelled me. I want to know more.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, let's take a little break there,
sure.
And we'll pick it back up. The Early Church Fathers intrigued you and led you on this new path, and so let's see what happens next after that. We'll be back in just a couple minutes to hear the rest of Dr. Justice Hunter's story. In the meantime, though, I want to remind you that if you go to chnetwork.org, you'll find a whole archive of stories like Dr. Justice's. You'll find episodes of the Journey Home program, as well as written stories, short interviews, but all sorts of stories of people from every background and how they came home and discovered the Catholic Church and discovered a deeper walk with Christ in the Catholic Church. So check that out at chnetwork.org. Again, we'll be back in just a couple minutes, so stay tuned to hear the rest of Justice's story. See you then. Well, welcome back to the Journey Home program. We're entering the second half of our hour tonight, speaking with Dr. Justice Hunter. He's a former Free Methodist and now the associate professor of church history at United Theological Seminary in Dayton, Ohio. And Justice, when we left off, you'd begun to read the Early Church Fathers, mm-hmm. And been intrigued by how they looked at Scripture, how they approached it. You encountered, writers who saw the Scriptures in a similar way to your holiness background,
right,
in terms of this transformation in Christ. And that led you to apply to Catholic schools to go where you could find a place to study this.
Right.
So what happened next?
Yeah, exactly right. So I got, the best stipend was offered from the University of Dayton, and I had a wife and kid at this point. Mm-hmm. So off we went so that we could eat while I read books. And so we went to the University of Dayton for 2 years. we moved to Dayton. There's no Free Methodist Church in Dayton. So that was kind of the first issue we had to work through. And so we kind of wrestled with that and landed at a United Methodist Church. So I kind of came back upstream through my family. My parents had been United Methodist. My grandparents are United Methodist on both sides. And they moved to Free Methodism. I was raised in that. Now I moved back to United Methodism while we were at Dayton. And I was really intrigued by Catholicism at the time, but my wife was not intrigued at all. She grew up in independent Christian churches, and it was too foreign. Going to a Free Methodist church, which is even lower kind of ritually than United Methodist Church, even was a step, a ritual upstream
more liturgical
steps. Yeah, exactly, for her, and so she was kind of more comfortable there. So I thought, okay, well, you know, I don't have to be Catholic to go to the Catholic school, but I can learn about the fathers from Catholics. And at this point, my reading had extended from the fathers really into the medievals, and especially with Thomas Aquinas, who is who I really wanted to learn to read. Had a great teacher there, Matthew Levering, who kind of mentored me and led me into reading scholastic theology. And that was like this is the thing I really want to invest in. But as a United Methodist, so finished a master's program there, applied for doctoral programs, and ended up, I thought I got the perfect option, which was Southern Methodist University, because at Southern Methodist University, there were the faculty I regarded as one, the best Methodist theologian on the planet, Billy Abraham, and then two, one of the best Catholic theologians on America, probably the planet in my estimation, also Bruce Marshall. I thought Bruce Marshall can teach me the medieval stuff, and Billy can help me think about what the heck I'm doing as a Methodist interested in this medieval stuff. So it was really the perfect spot for me. So off I go to Dallas for 4 years at SMU. It was wonderful. It was more than I had hoped for. They were both so compassionate, but also rigorous and serious, and could really take me into the questions I wanted to think about seriously while I was there. We went to the United Methodist Church there. We had a great United Methodist Church there, there in East Dallas. Became very close family friends with the pastor and his wife. This was a church that had a recent start that had just, was just booming. I think they had something like 2,000 people at worship by the time we were leaving on Easter Sunday. So it's really exciting, you know, kind of exciting environment. And people who were really United Methodists that were really serious about deepening the faith, deepening the sense of doctrinal kind of heritage, and all that just was exactly kind of like my bread and butter. It's like, like scratching the itch a little bit in Methodism. I finished there and, you know, went on the job market and it's kind of a miraculously got a job, which is not always normal. And I got one right out of school. So I defended my dissertation and then moved to Dayton to start teaching church history and theology. I teach kind of between those two disciplines. Okay. In typical Protestant seminary faculties, there's the slot. There's the two church history slots. You teach church history one, church history two, and then typically, you know, church history two is basically Reformation forward, and then the other one is anything before the Reformation, and that's the one that the Catholics usually end up in. But you have to decide: you're going to hire a medievalist, or you're going to hire a patristics person, and so that's kind of the slot I came in on. Yeah. Nice thing about teaching medievals, though, is you do a lot of theology, especially if you work in medieval scholastic theology like I do. So I kind of have worked between disciplines, kind of a utility player, you know, in that way. And what this meant was that I was teaching a lot of theology alongside church history in the Methodist Seminary as a United Methodist. And in the classroom, I started kind of wrestling with what does it mean to teach United Methodist theology? Mm-hmm. What doctrinal guidance do I receive from my church on what I'm supposed to be teaching these seminarians who are presumably going to be pastors? And that really forced me to wrestle with some aspects of Methodist doctrine that had been kind of frustrating to me. What I've been doing, I think, is trying to take a look at what I knew what the reality of United Methodist doctrine was like at the time. It's kind of a mess. But what I was trying to do is import my own account of what the kind of key tradition of the whole church was through the fathers as received in the medievals. And that, like, reattached that to this machine that basically says, you know, whatever goes doctrinally. And Methodist quadrilateral is often a tool used for doctrinal indifferentism, as we put it. And so I was like, well, if they're going to be indifferent, then might as well put my thing in there and just go with that. Okay. But then you start teaching pastors. And then you start asking yourself questions like, well, what really is holding up this vision of what Methodist theology is?
Right.
And if you're doing that, having read and continuing to read St. John Henry Newman, it generates a real intellectual crisis for you, because I just could not get over the fact that at the end of the day, it was me, the professors, my subjectivity, my subjective judgment about what the tradition was, which was determining what the content of the faith was, sort of. And that sort of, when Newman talks about what we need is for the objectivity of the faith to be impressed upon our subjectivity, so that it's sort of a reception. That, I couldn't figure out how to think about that as a Methodist theologian. So I really, really was kind of wrestling with that question. I also, pretty much through my study of church history, reading medieval theology, working through that, I had pretty much overcome any of the typical objections to Catholicism. You know, the Immaculate Conception wasn't a problem for me. Eucharistic doctrine wasn't a problem for me. Methodist doctrine of the Eucharist is sort of, is Calvin, Cranmer, Anglican doctrine. And so there is an emphasis on real presence. It's just you sort of play the mystery card really hard at that point, rather than thinking. And so there's sort of not the most robust objections to transubstantiation, as you would put it. And so I'd kind of worked through that. I'd read Thomas very carefully on those topics. And so intellectually, I think I was pretty open to Catholicism. In many ways, I think I was a very kind of Catholic Methodist on the faculty, which my colleagues liked, but I just was ecclesially Methodist. Now, one big thing was taking place at the same time in my life, and that was that sense of kind of need for belonging was rising up again. And for this, this meant sense of belonging in the academy. It's really kind of career-oriented sense of belonging. I wanted to become an established Methodist theologian with a significant contribution to make in that world, and was starting to write more in that area, speak more on that topic, produce more content that direction, get embroiled in minor debates and disagreements on that front, and all of that was just sort of taking off. Really, it was really, really moving forward as I would hope, and that really began to kind of grow as the place where I started to think about the center of my identity. It was church adjacent, but it was increasingly academic, and also sort of a lot of kind of sense of gratification, probably, and achievement. So I was just good. I liked that, just feeling good, and things are going forward. A few things happened, though. One was, the United Methodist Church was going through massive kind of internal division, and my school is a United Methodist seminary, and so we were going through the same sort of turmoil. My local church was going through that same turmoil. All of my friends were United Methodists embroiled in this, going through the same turmoil. So it was everywhere I went, it was just this tension, anxiety, frustration, spiritually just kind of agonizing, anxious in that world. And so all that's going on. And then my father gets ill. And so father's one of my closest friends, my mentor, my guide. He ran a marathon, was diagnosed 3 months later, and then was gone, 8 months after that. Oh. So that shook me. That really shook me. I really started thinking a little differently, kind of about my life, thinking more about who he was to me and who I wanted to be for my children, you know, and really kind of reorienting my identity around my family. That happened. Then the church I was going to just started kind of fragmenting over the social issues that are facing the church. And so that was kind of painful. And then my next door neighbor had kind of a episode. He struggled with, I think, a obsessive compulsive disorder. And that episode manifested in a lot of harassment of me personally. Mm. And then it started being directed at my wife. And so we thought, this is getting to be an increasingly dangerous and difficult place to live. So what we did was I was granted sabbatical. I was writing a book with a collaborator, another Methodist theologian. It's a book that a lot of Methodist churches use for catechesis for confirmation. It's a confirmation book. Mm-hmm. It's been pretty successful. We're writing that book. I moved my family to my in-laws' house in Tennessee. I kind of remodel the house, try to write, you know, find a house, move the family back, and we move across town at this point. At that point, we were like, okay, this is the time to exit that church that we had been in for a while. And so we do. We kind of cut ties there, and we go back on the church market again.
Yeah.
So we look at a couple of United Methodist churches. We didn't feel at home. Any of those were quite right for our family. A lot of them were older congregations. People wanted us to take our kids into like the quiet room in the back, you know. And so we really kind of struggle with that. Come to find out, I mean, my wife, we had been homeschooling our children in the local Catholic co-op because of friends I'd had at the University of Dayton who were Catholic, who were homeschooling. So all along, we've been kind of having this other space where our children are building relationships. Mm-hmm. And while I'm in this United Methodist world, totally absorbed, my wife, she's kind of in that world too, but now she's got this whole other community of homeschooling Catholic families and these women who are doing the same thing we're doing in our household. Whereas our Methodist friends are mostly sending their kids to private school or they have one or two children. It's just a very different lifestyle they're living. They're both dual income.
Right.
Is a typical pattern. Well, I was totally surprised. My wife, who had been completely disinterested, says, "Why don't we just go to Mass?" And I said, "Really?" She said, "Yeah, you know, I've been looking at these moms and I just admire their lives. They have these prayers that they can center their family around. They talk about building the church in the home. I really like, I need to figure out that's what we need in our house. So let's just go to Mass and see what happens." But plus the kids' friends are there, you know. Yeah. And so we just start going to Mass on Saturday night. We go to the vigil Mass. And then on Sunday morning, I alone would get up and go to the United Methodist Church because I still felt professionally obligated to do so. Or they might come with me periodically.
Yeah.
Initially, they started coming. But then eventually, they're like, "Oh, I think we're just going to go to Mass," you know. So the next thing I know, my wife is saying, "I think I might go to RCIA." I'm like, "Really?" She's like, "Yeah." And then we start having conversations. What do you think? What would it look like for us to raise our kids Catholic? I was at this point so frustrated with the United Methodist Church, and our children are aging. For me, the question became, okay, when my oldest graduates high school and I send him to college somewhere, am I going to encourage him to go to the closest United Methodist Church? How do I feel about that decision?
Right. Where will it be at that time?
Exactly.
Yeah.
And I knew the answer was never, you know, never. I would not encourage,
yeah,
if I knew the pastor or something.
Sure.
No, that I wouldn't do that. So I said, actually, I think this is a good decision for our family. I think raising our kids Catholic gives me a much more stable and confident sense that they will be raised in the faith and be given the resources they need in life to grow up and be as committed, you know, be committed Christians, which is what is important to us on the way. So they were received in 2020, a year before me, actually.
Wow.
They were received. It's beautiful, wonderful. I held my daughter as she was baptized, one of my daughters as she was baptized. and it was really a joyous occasion. But then at that point, I was really conflicted because at this point, I really felt obligated to Methodism. I thought I was obligated. It was really the attachments I had to people, to endeavors we were doing. I was teaching theology as a Methodist in a Methodist seminary. That seemed to have some sort of commitments to it. And I wanted to do the honorable thing. So I was really kind of anxious. I was talking to my dean, and I said, you know, Ellen's in the church now. The kids are in the church. I've been going to Mass and Methodist church. It's kind of a drag to, you know, do all that. And he said, you want to be Catholic, don't you? And I said, well, yeah, it would simplify my life in a lot of ways. That's what I told him. And he said, I don't think so. No, I think that's a bad decision. You know, you're on this trajectory. You know, maybe you'll we've got things planned for you, you know. Mm-hmm. That was his initial reaction. I was like really dispirited by that. I was like, man, this is not encouraging. What am I going to do? I'm going to Mass. I'm drawn to the Mass. I already was intellectually convinced, but my livelihood is tied up with this.
Right.
We're single income family, and my identity has really kind of been built around this thing mm-hmm. at this point. So,
and that belonging that you look
exactly.
for.
Exactly. You know, I was feeling it. Yeah. I belonged, yeah. you know, in yeah. the rooms, you know, where mm-hmm. these things were happening, you know, I was wanted to be there.
Right.
And I was getting that. I was really getting that. All that happened while my father was going through this process. Yeah. So I would just sort of, was like, well, I guess we'll just kind of plod along here and see what happens. I started praying. I talked to friends, asked them to pray for me, Methodist and Catholic friends. And I found myself, through the grieving of my father's passing, increasingly like just I needed to be held, you know. I needed the church to hold me, support me, to give me words to pray in the midst of my grief. And Rome was the church that was doing that for me, increasingly. I was sitting in St. Joseph's Catholic Church in Dayton, praying at the they have all the stained glass are images of St. Joseph's life in this church. And they have an image of, they have a stained glass window of, I would call it Joseph's dormition. I don't know what you call it.
Right.
His death, yeah. His deathbed. That's my father's dying. And then I went there several times to pray and contemplate that image. And that process, the whole process of my father passing and also kind of coming to these fragments, I think that God was reorienting my identity a different way through this process. And increasingly, I just felt really drawn to St. Joseph. So I started kind of asking St. Joseph to pray for me, seeking his prayers, intercession. And what came out of that was I started kind of contemplating the virtues of St. Joseph's life, his humility, the way in which he kind of recedes and steps back. And in that, I sort of started to find the courage to kind of think about letting go of this other thing that I'd found, this kind of sense of belonging and achievement, identity, accomplishment, future importance and significance, and start thinking about, well, really wanting to think about how to live those virtues of St. Joseph's life. So that's going on spiritually inside me. Well, I still have the problem with my employer. Well, in the midst of all, I'm praying about this. A month or so goes by after that conversation. Dean knocks on my door, comes to my office, shuts the door, and says, Justice, I need to talk to you about something. I say, okay, you know, what's going on? We're very good friends still, very dear friends. He says, I've been thinking about what I said when we talked about your conversion. And he said, I think I was just speaking out of my own kind of vision and, you know, and hopes. And I just want you to know, you know, I want you to do what you think is best for you and for your family. And the school will figure, you know, it'll be good for the school too. We'll just believe that's going to be true. Which I thought was, first of all, incredible character on his part.
Yeah.
Very admirable, but also the sign kind of I needed.
Yeah.
So that I went home, told my wife, and signed up for RCIA that moment, you know. talked to my priest and kind of went through the process and was received in the church that next Easter.
Praise God.
After, you know, that fall, I applied for tenure. Mm-hmm. So I did this before tenure, though. That was kind of anxious. But I thought I need to do this before they grant me tenure, because it would be a bad witness to say,
sure,
like a bait and switch,
sure,
if I do it
sure.
like immediately after. And so I applied and they granted me tenure, which is good on the Methodists. And actually they've continued to kind of welcome me, not close any doors to, mm-hmm. to my opportunity for leadership there in the institution. It's working.
Good.
It has its challenges, but it's working. So then that was it. I was confirmed with the name Saint with Joseph, and now I've really, as I was coming over here, I was thinking about sort of how to think about what all has happened. For so long, I was looking for a place where I felt accepted, belonging, and where I could just kind of rest and be comfortable for me, and I kind of was wanting kind of that affirmation or something. I think what I've seen as I've become Catholic and I've started living this Catholic life, and especially contemplating St. Joseph, so much more I'm finding is that in the Catholic life, we find our sense of belonging by sort of self-dispossession, by giving ourselves away. And what I aspire to be is someone who's not identified by kind of being kind of recognized, but someone who is oriented around their giving of themselves to primarily my children, my family.
Yeah.
Joseph was important to that, because this was a total reorientation around my family, professionally, personally, total reorientation about investing kind of that as my primary locus and work. But then also kind of beyond that, investing in my students, investing in whoever God kind of puts in my path, which are a lot of the students that come to me. And sort of this trying to find a sense of belonging through service and through giving of myself for the sake of others. And that even has changed the way I'm thinking about kind of my work as a researcher, as a scholar as well. It now emerges rather than doing my work sort of in the typical driven academic way, where it's like, this is my research directory. What are you doing? I'm doing this thing. I'm doing this. I've got a plan, and that's the thing I'm going after, which I'm not saying that all academics do that, but that's how I was wired beforehand. Now I'm finding that a lot of my work emerges out of my commitment to the students that I have. You know, what research? I still have passion for the research, you know, but how does that part of what I work serve them? And how do I keep that from detracting from service to them as well?
Right.
And that's been really a huge transition. I'm very early in the project. I'm only 3 years into this project. But that's been really huge transformation for me, kind of a turning of that sense of trying to fill myself with a sense of acceptance and belonging. And now to kind of give that sense of belonging and welcome, and then just self-sacrifice for others in that sense. I think that's where I'm thinking.
Yeah.
It's happening.
Yeah. Well, that's beautiful. And certainly it's a great reminder here that our focus on the show is about people discovering the Catholic Church, but we know and we constantly are reminded and we remind each other that it's just another starting point, right, for the lifelong journey. And that's the deeper journey. That's the harder journey of turning outward and almost like reinterpreting everything in our life. Like, we might be doing a lot of the same stuff, a lot of the same relationships, same work, but it's like looking at it from a whole different angle, where now it's an outward focused thing. It's a relational focused thing. It's receiving it, not grasping it as something that's for me, but receiving it as a gift to give away.
Yeah, exactly. That's what it was for me. I mean, I'm pretty probably prone to avarice or something, you know, and prideful person. And so I really struggle with that. And so that's exactly kind of the transformation that's taking place. It's hard. I mean, I went from being someone that, you know, bishops in the Methodist Church or like leaders would maybe call and ask to be on committees and do these types of things, write these things, speak at things. That pretty much just ended overnight for me.
Right.
And not entirely. There's still little ventures where kind of ecumenical stuff works. And I have friends. I was just at Baylor speaking, and so there are places that are welcome. But it cut way back because
right.
It was a real letting go. And I confess, some days I grieve that. You know, I grieve that kind of sense of self and identity that I'd kind of been cultivating previously. But I know that that needs to die. That's got to die.
You know, so here at the Coming Home Network, you know, we work with people who are becoming Catholic, and that people in your position is something we've always had a heart for in the sense of pastors, but also, you know, with a wider circle of academics and missionaries, people for whom becoming Catholic is not just going to RCIA and sort of just showing up at a different church service, but it really does dig into identity and profession and vocation and, you know, the whole sense of what you've been working towards. And that's many Catholics, many lay converts don't quite recognize that unique position that you're in. Again, with just a few minutes left, you know, a little bit of, you know, how has Catholic life continued with your family?
So we've been, my wife pulls me along in most things. One thing we've really, really loved has been the amazing resources for building the church in the home Catholicism has. It's not a fault of Methodist. I mean, I was raised by really devoted Methodists. I knew a lot of people who are just incredible sanctity and devotion. At Asbury, I was really, really marveled at some of the lives I saw. These are people for whom being a Christian is the most basic truth about them and their shapes their whole life.
Right.
But they're, I just felt like, for us, doing that, it felt like something I had to kind of, we had to make up or something like that. And we'd be kind of leeching off Rome. We'd kind of start, my wife started bringing stuff she was finding through this homeschool co-op into our house, saying, hey, you know, we should start celebrate some feast days. Maybe lean into Lent a little harder this year, you know. What do you think about doing, you know, let's do 12 days of Christmas and let's do charitable work, distinct charitable works all every 12 days, you know, she'd bringing this stuff into our house. And now it's just sort of like full tilt that way.
Right.
One of the things we did, recently that I think has really made a significant difference in our home, it was my wife's idea. My mother loved to move furniture. I was the oldest boy. I hated the furniture. It was, you know, all the time, you know, rearrange is just one of her things. Well, my wife is the same way. And so it's kind of always this joke. She'll still say, hey, honey, you know, I got an idea, you know, I'm like, oh gosh, you know, what do I have to move? And so she comes to me, she says, I got an idea. Let's move the dining room, which was the center room in our house, the way it was laid out. Mm-hmm. Let's just move that into the front room, which would be your typical idea, so that we can create a prayer room in the center of our house. I was like, that seems weird. And it involves moving furniture. So I'm naturally opposed to it. But she just sort of, you know, she outfoxes me typically. And so, you know, next thing I know, we're moving the dining room in there. But it was absolutely brilliant. We've built kind of a whole room devoted to prayer, but also, you know, there are some chairs around. We can invite friends into it also.
Right.
And now we're able to kind of center every gathering in this space. These icons and religious art and our rosaries and kind of all this. And it's also the space where I go and sit first thing in the morning. Mm-hmm. And we pray, you know, we pray our evening prayers together and things like that. That's been really, it's stuff like that mm-hmm. has really fed and nourished my faith and then also integrated it much more deeply into my family's faith. That's become kind of the center of this. So that's been huge.
That's beautiful. And again, a great way to sort of end it and think of this going forward, you know, discovering the church, you know, writ large, But then the continuing journey of then bringing mm-hmm. that home to the domestic church,
yeah.
right? Which we're blessed as husbands and fathers, right. along with our wives, to build. And it's an ongoing journey.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
That's thanks so much for sharing your story, Justice.
Thank you.
Praying for your family and for your continued work teaching history there. And thank you for joining us for this episode of the Journey Home program. I pray that Dr. Justice's story was an inspiration to you. Remember, again, we're all on a journey, right? And we're blessed, you know, that God has led us to his church. But we recognize that it's just the starting gun, right? This is the beginning of the rest of the journey for the rest of our lives, which is to bring the church out there, bring it in here in terms of our habits and how we think and how we act, how we imitate Christ. And that's an ongoing journey. We need to be praying for each other as we go along it. So in the meantime, we'll be back next week for another episode of the Journey Home program, another story. But until then, God bless.